Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media simply doesn't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after The Deep State. I want to bring on now Jackson Hinkle. Jackson is an American political commentator. He has one of the most engaged accounts on X in the entire world, and he's the host of the daily show Legitimate Targets on YouTube. I'm going to ask you to compare yourself to some of these other influencers and political commentators who have really made names for themselves, especially in the United States. What responsibility do you think influencers and political commentators have when it comes to discussing conflicts and wars or breaking international events? I'm thinking about, for example, Candace Owen. For a long time, I thought Candace Owen was a nut. And lately, I've been thinking, well, Candace Owen really talks some sense on some of these issues. Now, she still says some nutty things, like, I will never believe that the Egyptian Air Force killed Charlie Kirk, which has long been her position. I will never believe that Mrs. Macron is a man, which has long been her position. But on some of these other issues, she's really talking sense. So what responsibility do you think people like Candace or, you know, Tucker Carlson or anybody who commands a large following have when talking about these big international issues?
Well, I'll just say as a brief caveat, because I you know, during the Charlie Kirk stuff, I was like religiously watching her podcast. The only thing, you know, I don't agree with her on everything either. Like, I don't believe that Stalin killed like 600 quadrillion Christians or whatever she claims.
Right.
Which also Tucker kind of talks about that. I love both of them, but
yeah,
you know, let's be real. But the Egyptian plane, I think she's kind of saying like, oh, you know, it's an Egyptian flagged plane, or they, but maybe it's really an Israeli plane. I don't know. I'm not fully sure of whether she knows what she believes in regarding that story either with the planes, but you know, the Israelis have done at least reconnaissance flights in previous wars where they've used planes that are either no markings or markings that resemble that of their own adversary. So I wouldn't be surprised if anything nowadays. But I think that Tucker, Candace, amazing. I hope Tucker, you know, I heard Alex Jones this morning say that Tucker was named by Sebastian Gorka as being under this counterterrorism investigation.
Yeah.
How Sebastian Gorka got into that position, I have no idea. British agent, Israeli British agent, Ukrainian agent, I have no idea. But Tucker, I think, should take the opportunity, strike while the iron's hot, announce his candidacy for president. I would 1,000,000% support him, whatever that means for Tucker, probably nothing. But I think he needs to understand that a lot more Americans would support him than anyone else. And it's amazing. Someone like Tucker, a Fox News conservative his whole life, he's got me on his side. I'm a communist. He's got
Seriously.
George Galloway on his side. He's got everyone. He's got the libertarians. It's like, I don't know. I would love to see that. And obviously, I can't imagine what sort of a sacrifice that would be. But I think the ultimate goal of influencers, if they're talking about politics, should be to effect political change. And it's really kind of, I think, shameful when you have Americans on social media with big followings complaining so much and making so much money off of it in the process, but not doing anything really even slightly creative to try and change the system.
You're so right. You're so right. Blah, blah, blah. What's the whole purpose if you just sit in front of a camera every day and just say blah, 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 blah? It doesn't make any difference. I saw Tucker a couple of weeks ago, and I said to him, you've got to run for president. You've got to. I said, I know that Glenn Greenwald talked to you about this a week ago. You've got to run for president, and if you do, I'm all in. I said, I'll do anything you want me to do. And I fully expected him to push back, because I've said this to him before. This time was different. This time, and he might even tell me I'm looking too far into it. This time he didn't say no. He said, well, I like my life the way it is, and I don't think my wife would be happy if I ran for president, and my son's just got married, and, you know, he went on and on, but he didn't say no. So I'm hoping, man, I'm hoping for the best, because the system that we have in the United States is irretrievably broken. I said just the other day on a show that as recently as 100 years ago, we had like 6 viable political parties in the United States. 6. 150 years ago, if you were, let's say, a cabinet member or a senior member of Congress and you didn't like something that your party leadership did, you just switched parties. There were a half a dozen parties or more that you could switch to. Solomon P. Chase, who was the Secretary of the Treasury under Abraham Lincoln, was a member of 5 different political parties over the course of his career. Because every time they took a position that he disagreed with, he would just move to a different party, move to this party, move to that party. You know, we had the Whigs, which became the Republicans, and then there were the Radical Republicans and the Conservative Republicans, and then the Democrats were the Southern Democrats and the anti-slavery Democrats. Okay, so why is it that the Libertarians always get 1% and the Greens always get a half of 1%? It can't be because every American either loves the Republicans or loves the Democrats. I live here. I know that that's just simply not true. But we've convinced ourselves that the duopoly is the way to go. And it's not the way to go. It holds us back. And then we can't understand why in a good year, 50% of registered voters actually bother to go cast a vote. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like you, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I was a third-generation Democrat, and I left the Democratic Party because, in my view, it moved far too far to the right, especially on these issues of civil liberties and foreign policy and defense. And there might as well just be Republicans. All the stuff that the Democrats stand for today are things that Ronald Reagan advocated in the 1980s. And we thought he was so far extreme right wing that he couldn't possibly get elected president. And then he won 49 states. And now he's so liberal by today's standards that he could never win a Republican nomination. And that's where the Democrats are today. So what about the rest of us that believe in, you know, no war, full employment, labor unions? What about us? I don't like either one of these guys. And then what? I'm made to feel like an extremist? I'm a left-wing extremist? Give me a break. I'm mainstream. But the rest of them don't want to admit it. It's very frustrating. And, you know, Tucker said to me, he said, you and I probably disagree on fully half of the issues. I said, I don't care. I've known you for more than a decade. I trust you. And I know that every time your mouth opens to say something to me, you're telling me the truth. And that's what the country needs right now. Maybe I don't agree with it, but you're telling me the truth. So if you have any influence with Tucker Carlson, lay it on, man. Tell him his country needs him. Everybody else is.
I second that. Whoever hears. I told George Galloway. By the way, George said a very similar story to what you just said the last time I spoke to him about it. And I know Jimmy Dore was going to shoot him a text about it, too. Not that he hasn't before. I know he has. But just reiterate, of course. So I second that. For anyone who has any sort of, you know, good friendship with Tucker, let's let him know that there is support from all corners of American political and apolitical life for him doing something like this. I mean, it'd just be so beautiful. And what a middle finger to those Sebastian Gorkas and Kash Patels and whoever else that are trying to go after him for saying that we shouldn't pursue proxy wars and war with Iran and whatever else. It's like, yeah, you want to do that? We're gonna make him president. You want to try to do some BS counterterrorism, whatever charges, investigation. No, we're gonna make him president. Actually,
amen to that.
That's what I hope for.
Amen to that. That's exactly what I hope for. I will say, you know, he used to live, of course, here in Washington. Well, no, I'm not in Washington now. He used to live in Washington, and left during COVID, moved to New England, built a little house, and has lived happily ever after. And I asked him once, I said, why all the way up here? He lives way out in the woods. And he said that it was his favorite place from childhood. He always loved it. He's an avid fly fisherman, so he goes fishing almost every day. And and his family loves it. And I think he would be reluctant to come back to Washington. But, you know, maybe if we're able to convince him that his country needs him, we can get him to make that decision. That would be pretty good.
Look, Nixon had the Western White House in San Clemente, California.
Yes, he did.
On the beaches just north of Camp Pendleton. That's where I grew up. I remember visiting it when I was a kid. Tucker can have his Northeastern White House or something.
That's it.
Or he grew up in Carlsbad. He can actually go back to Nixon's old Western White House if it's not privately owned.
I'll tell you what, there are very few places in the United States that I would like to live more than Carlsbad.
Yeah. Yeah. Carlsbad. All of that area is just, I think, some of the most pristine pieces of beachfront that we have in America. But,
yeah.
John, if I have time, can I ask you one more question? I don't know.
Please.
If
go right ahead.
Okay. One of the things that I've heard you say, speaking about your youth, we were talking about Tucker's youth, speaking about your youth, you say that you were just infatuated with Middle Eastern
yes.
poetry and culture and things like this.
Yes.
I definitely have like come to learn about that stuff. I wasn't interested from my youth or anything. And you said that that's what led you to pursue, I believe it was not just Arabic language, but did you also pursue Arabic studies?
Yes, I got a degree in Middle Eastern studies. And it's funny, at George Washington University, it was a relatively new degree program. I was one of only four students in it, in a student body of, you know, 30 plus thousand people. And I went to the dean and I said I had a complaint about the program. The political studies are great, but there's no requirement to study Islam or oil economics. And that just didn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Don't tell me how to run my program, kid." So he seriously did. So George Washington University was part of something called the DC Consortium, or the Consortium of DC Universities. And I found an oil economics class at Georgetown University. So I took oil economics at Georgetown. And then a year later, GW hired Syed Hossein Nasser, the father of Vali Nasser, who used to be, well, he was the Shah of Iran's last chief of staff, but politics aside, he was one of the greatest thinkers in contemporary Shiism. And so I studied under him for the next 2 years. I remember the first class that I took from him, he assigned 12 books on Islam, and he had written all 12 of them, which just impressed the heck out of me. He's still alive. He's something like 98 years old and living here in the United States. But he opened up a whole new world for me. And also, I was very fortunate in that when I was a freshman, Iranian students who had fled the revolution were juniors and seniors. When I was a senior, we were getting the refugees from the Lebanese Civil War. So I was surrounded by Muslims. In that program, I learned so much from them about the culture, about the language, about the religion. I couldn't get enough. I've said, too, in podcasts, I told my parents when I was 9 years old that I wanted to be a spy when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that was cute, and they bought me walkie-talkies for Christmas. My brother and I would run around the neighborhood talking to each other on the walkie-talkies. But when I was 16 years old, I told my father specifically that I wanted to be a spy in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And he was like, "Oh, still with the spy stuff, can't you be a dentist or something?" I said, "Dad, I really want to be a spy and I want to live in the Middle East." He thought I was nuts. And then I ended up being a spy in the Middle East.
The main question I wanted to ask you about that was like, with that profound love and appreciation of these different cultures and stuff, How did your career, I guess, I don't know the best way to phrase this. Like, for example, when I visit countries that seem, or parts of countries that seem like well within the hands of the bad guys, the American adversaries.
Yes.
I go to those places and in many instances, it feels like you're in the heart, right? Yes. You're in the heart of the country, like in Sana'a or in Sada'a in Yemen. Whereas maybe if I was elsewhere in the country, it might feel very different. It might feel like the culture has been lost.
Yes.
It might feel like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or affiliates are running things. And same could be said, I think, about other countries that have gone through color revolutions and things like this in the past. And I've listened to a lot of your stories. And while, you know, I fully support taking out like Al-Qaeda, and I fully support taking out Daesh and these other affiliated groups across the world, JNIM and Boko Haram, whoever. Did it ever, like, I guess, counter kind of your love and appreciation for the sovereign cultures of these countries with maybe what others in the agency or others in the Pentagon were doing, outside of just the sheer power of war, but about the stripping of the sovereignty of these cultures?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's actually an important question. For a very long time, I truly believed we were the good guys. I really did. And I thought, well, we're on the side of right. We're on the side of human rights. I mean, this was the narrative during the Clinton administration, for example, that we're on the side of human rights. And it wasn't until 9/11 that I realized how false that narrative was. And it continued. I remember going to Yemen. I've been to Yemen 5 times. And every time, I mean, between 1990 and 2011. And every time I go, it's worse than it is on the previous trips. But I remember going to Yemen the first time. There were two Yemens. There was Northern Yemen called the Yemen Arab Republic. And then there was PIDRI, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. And they were so excited because they were unifying that April. And people were literally dancing in the streets. I'd never seen anything like that before in my life. Literally dancing in the streets. And then you fast forward, you know, a decade, and they've shot Scud missiles at one another, and there are, you know, armed conflicts all around the country, and they don't produce food anymore because they're all raising ghat. And the country is just a basket.
I love the cons.
I know. It takes getting used to. I didn't like it so much.
And the honey.
The honey's awesome. Yes. But, you know, it made me realize we're seriously on the wrong side of so many of these issues. When I was there in 2009, I was the chief investigator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I went to do a study. And I was talking to the U.S. Defense Attaché, and he was bragging to me about all the money that he was spending on what he called a PSYOPS program, a psychological operations program. And I said, well, what's the operation? And he said, well, the operation is that we're sponsoring a talk show on a radio station geared toward young men. And we play jazz, and then they're able to call in and comment on the jazz. And I looked at him, and I said, Colonel, with all due respect, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard in my life. What are you doing? You're spending the American taxpayers' money running a jazz show in Sana'a? They can't eat. They don't have shoes for their children. And you're spending money on a jazz show? And he looked at me like I was crazy. But it's just like people in government just don't get it. This is another thing. This is an affliction of Washington, D.C., is we all think we are so smart that we're the smartest people in the world. And everybody else is an idiot, and they need to have everything explained to them. So, you know, this guy's position was, oh, he came up with an idea to put an hour-long jazz show on some random radio station in Sana'a, and he expected everybody to applaud him. Like, he couldn't imagine why would this guy from Washington come in here and tell me my business that it's a bad idea to have a jazz show in Sana'a? But that's Washington. When I was working for John Kerry, I saw it every single day, literally every day. where John Kerry believed he was smarter than you, and he was smarter than me, and smarter than everybody else. And so every time he would come up with a stupid idea, he would expect people to nod and clap and say, "Congratulations, Mr. Chairman, that's an act of genius." No, actually it's not. It's a stupid idea. There it is.
But he did shift his opinion on his friendship with Assad, as you told a story even that, it's like, is that really? I mean, I know it was a different time, Duma allegations.
Sure.
Okay. But is that really like as simple as it is for some of these people in D.C.?
Oh, yes,
you can say, hey, don't talk to that guy anymore.
Oh, my gosh, yes. What you're referring to is one of only two times that I gave John Kerry unsolicited advice on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I said to him one day, "Senator, you have got to stop calling Bashar al-Assad my dear friend." I said, "Every Lebanese in Washington is calling me, and they're asking me, what is your boss doing calling Bashar al-Assad my dear friend?" And he said to me, "We rode motorcycles together to the Golan Heights, and we really bonded." And I said, "And I'm sure that's true, but you can't call him my dear friend in public. It's a bad look." And he's like, all right. And I don't even know
that's
if he listened, but yeah, that's just how they are, because they're smarter than we are.
Motorbikes with Assad to the Golan Heights. That's, I can't imagine the stories, but wow. Well, yeah, I always thought about that earlier question I had for you, because I'm like, you know, the way you talk, you learned Arabic, you do have such a deep appreciation that we can all see. And I'm like, I look at these agencies today that operate, you know, outside of the shadows in the light, and I just look at them, I'm like, I don't think any of these people appreciate the thousands of years old cultures that they're bombing right now.
No.
Or trying to influence in some way and turn into what we have in Syria now, some of the oldest cities on the face of the earth. And now they're hosting like these weird Nicki Minaj basketball games for Jolani.
Yes.
I don't even know what it.
Oh, I've
what
got to
Syria
tell you,
is anymore.
I've got to tell you, I had dinner with a senior Turkish government official, I'm going to say 4 or 5 weeks ago, senior level. He was in Washington. He reached out to me and said he wanted to take me to dinner and talk about foreign policy from the perspective of an informed private citizen. I said, great, how do you turn that down? So as soon as we sat down, I said, listen, before we talk, you got to get out of Cyprus. You just have to get out of Cyprus. There can't be peace anywhere in the region while you're in Cyprus. He says, okay, all right, that's not what I wanted to talk about. I said, okay, I'm happy to talk about whatever you want, but you have to get out of Cyprus. So we got to the point of talking about Syria. And I said to him, because I'm an idiot sometimes, I said, Jolani, this guy has to be a CIA asset, right? He has to be. I mean, he comes out of nowhere. He's the former co-founder of ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call it. He's a former senior commander of Al-Qaeda. He appears to be installed in the presidency of Syria practically overnight, just like that. And then the very next day, the president of the United States congratulates him and lifts all sanctions. I said, that just has CIA written all over it. He has to be CIA. And the guy laughed and he said, no, he's ours. Turkish National Intelligence Organization. We created him from nothing and we installed him in Syria. I said, you know what? That actually makes more sense. But yeah, he proudly, gladly just came out with it that Jolani is a Turkish asset, which I thought was quite dramatic and utterly believable.
Yeah. I remember Max Blumenthal in Management of Savagery, his amazing book everyone should read. He talked a lot about the rat lines of weapons that they were running to those guys in Syria, and how when they'd get injured, they'd go right across the border into Turkey and be treated for whatever injuries they had. Then they'll go back to, eventually they'll find themselves in Idlib and they're running these like giant, whatever it is, fuel, drugs, whatever it is, running stuff and making money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's funny because the Turks have this odd relationship with the Kurds. Like, they're okay with the Iraqi Kurds, kind of. They don't at all like the Syrian Kurds. They actively hate their own Kurds. But then they're willing to sort of deal with everybody else. It's a tenuous situation there. I want to add one other thing about Syria. The first time I ever went to Syria, I was preparing to go to Syria for the very first time. It was 1992, I think. And Hafez al-Assad was the leader of Syria at the time. And my boss said to me, "So Syria, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm excited to go to Syria. I've never been to Syria before." And he said, "Yeah, it's going to be pretty great, but you're never going to actually meet another Syrian, and you'll certainly never see the inside of a Syrian's home." I said, "Okay, whatever." So I go, and surveillance was very heavy. When I say very heavy, I mean like comically heavy, where I'm walking down the street, and the car from the Syrian intelligence service is driving at 2.5 miles an hour alongside of me. Finally, I turn, I'm like, "Guys, come on. I'm just going to go to the restaurant over here. You're welcome to join me," which they did, I might add. But anyway, I went to the souk, to the bazaar, because I wanted to buy one of these famous Damascus tablecloths that everybody was raving about. I wanted to give it to my mother. And so I go, and the guy asks me, "And Min Wayne, where are you from?" I said, "Min al-Wilayat al-Mutahida, from the United States." And he gasps. And I thought he was going to, like, run screaming from the room and pull down the grate and close the shop. He had just never met an American before. The guy was, like, in his 50s. He had never met an American. An hour later, I'm in his kitchen with his wife and his kids, and she's covering the table in food. And it was one of the most wonderful experiences I ever had. I found the Syrians to be kind and fun and highly educated and just all around wonderful people. They live in a terrible neighborhood, and they're victims of, you know, great power machinations, but I found them to be wonderful people. Thank you very much for being with us today. That was our guest, Jackson Hinkle. And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember, keep asking the questions that the government wants you to ignore. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.